session number 20062, Reel 2.
Brigadier Ben's Reel 2.
When we were driving on and going quite fast, there was a very different attitude because there was no damage, and they hadn't suffered from the war, really, from the battle, and they were delighted that we were there, and everybody came out to wave, and the girls came and kissed the soldiers and threw flowers into the trucks and all that. And particularly as we got up to Belgium and outside Brussels and there, the welcome was unbelievable. Well, I also saw this rather extraordinary sight of girls in the villages and towns having their heads shaved, presumably because they'd been consorting with the Germans. And that wasn't a very attractive sight. And probably pretty unfair, I should think, too, because I'm quite sure that the Germans had been in occupation for many years, 4 years, and no doubt many of them had behaved very reasonably. And one can see that they would have made friends with the locals. However, it was the resistance. You met resistance people, or these people who said they'd been in the resistance. And it was the resistance leaders who ordained that this head shaving should take place. Anyhow, we then when the breakout occurred, which I think was in August, was it? And we started trundling forward. We then came up through over the Seine at Vernon, and on through Beauvais, and then up to the outskirts of Brussels. Unfortunately, although some of our officers did get in with the Guards Armored Div into Brussels, I didn't myself. We were just outside, I think a place called Allost, and then went round the north of Brussels to the Albert Canal, just south of the Dutch border. South of Eindhoven, where we remained for a bit in preparation for the great drive up to Nijmegen and Arnhem. And we were there, I suppose, south of the canal for, I think, I'm trying to remember the name of the place, was it Beringen? I think so. And we saw the gliders going over in September, I suppose it was, 44. And then for this operation, which was called Market Garden. And I remember thinking at the time, we'd been briefed on this for 2 or 3 days. And I remember thinking then, and I recorded it, that it was odd that we should all have been told what the plan was, i.e. to capture the rivers, crossings of the Maas and the Rhine, and get up to Arnhem, and even further than that, and to defeat the Germans, and then turn right and go to the Ruhr. And I thought that was rather overplaying the sort of information game, which should all have been kept very much quieter, because if we were told right down to our level, I should think this news was going to get around, and the Germans probably heard about it. And as you know, there were unexpectedly large forces of Germans at Arnhem when the airborne dropped in. Anyway, we went forward supporting, who was it? The Guards Armored Div, I think, were leading there, and followed up by 50 Div, still in 30 Corps artillery. And we came up after a day or two. It was very exciting, actually, because you could see these Typhoon aircraft, which were rocket-firing aircraft, very effective against tanks and other vehicles, diving down ahead onto this one road. We all went up one road through Eindhoven and then up to Wesel, and then on the way to Nijmegen. And of course the Americans had dropped their airborne divisions, 101 and 82, and then the third division to drop was going to be, was the first British Airborne. And the first two drops were pretty successful. They captured the bridges intact over the at Wesel over the Maas, and then at Nijmegen over the Rhine, but not the further bridge at Arnhem, which was the first Airborne's objective. And we all went up this road with fearful traffic jams. I mean, division, two divisions or three divisions, all trying to get up one road all together. And the Germans attacking from each side because there was no width in this assault at all. And they frequently cut the road behind us and in front of us. And once we'd got to Nijmegen, we suddenly found, instead of driving on across the bridge, which you'd all expected, we were told to turn right and get into action in the town, because, I mean, the first airborne attack had not been a success. And the road behind us by then had been cut by the Germans, and we lived on German rations for, oh, I don't know, 3 or 4 days, which wasn't very nice. Extraordinary different standard of food they had, and the black bread, which the soldiers disliked intensely. And there were still Germans about, I'm sure, because while we were in Nijmegen, we moved our gun positions about, oh, I don't know, 3 or 4 times, and every time after, well, no time, a few minutes almost, certainly half an hour or an hour, we were shelled. And we had quite a few casualties there in Nijmegen. And I then went off to an American airborne battalion, because they were very short of artillery. They'd only got these very light guns. And so I was a sort of liaison officer with the American Airborne, 82nd Airborne. I think it was 50. I can't remember the name of the regiment. I think it was 504 or 505, facing south, southeast, towards the Reichswald Forest. And we had a rather difficult time because we were firing in two completely opposite directions. We were firing in support of the Americans down towards the Reichswald, and we were firing in support of the remains of 1st Airborne and the troops that were trying to relieve them, 43 Div, to the north. And so some of the guns were pointing one way and some were pointing exactly the other way, which caused some problems for the command post, but it seemed to work quite well. And I stayed with the Americans, I suppose, for the best part of a week, living in a hole in the ground. It was quite a change being with Americans. I don't want to generalize and things change, but they seemed slightly, their airborne troops were some of their best, and they'd already experienced battle here and there. And I thought they were rather remarkably brave, if not foolhardy. It sounds ridiculous, but they take their war very seriously. And if you can, the British soldier will always make himself, or did, as comfortable as possible. I mean, the trucks that pulled our guns, if you didn't watch it, were so full of mattresses and bits of food and sacks of potatoes and bottles of fruit and occasionally chickens and things, that it was extremely difficult to find the shells at the bottom. And when they got to somewhere and they could dig in for a few days, you'd find the sort of dugouts around the guns lined with wood and with practically pictures on the wall and a stove going in the corner and mattresses on the floor. Well, the Americans didn't play that game at all. They lived in discomfort. They made very little attempt to eat undercover or to improve their rations by local purchase or theft or whatever. And but on the other hand, they were very, this particular lot I was with, I thought were very, very efficient indeed, and very good soldiers. And I've always, ever since, and I've worked with Americans again, luckily, had great admiration for the American Army. And there are those who, in the past, and certainly before that date, and subsequently criticized the Americans for many shortcomings, and I think that's usually very unfair. I think they're terrific. Anyway, going on from there, that particular period in September ended in stalemate because we failed to get Arnhem, and Antwerp had not been cleared, and we therefore supplies and ammunition and everything was still coming all the way up from Normandy. So the great thing was to get Antwerp, and that we weren't involved in, and we merely took up a position just outside Nijmegen, near a village called Alphen, I think, between the two Rhines. The Rhine split around Arnhem and Nijmegen, then comes together again, and there's a sort of island. We were on this island, and firing at a bridge through which most of the Germans would have to escape coming up from the Antwerp area, and it's called Zaltbommel. Anyway, we stayed there for a month or two, and without a great deal going on, because I know we Nijmegen, although it was within range of enemy artillery, became quite a sort of pleasant town. And we had been, when we first got there, we took up a position on the southern, well, the eastern edge of the town. Very odd, it had been a sort of theme park, a religious theme park. And all over it were little tableaus of stories from the gospel. There was a monastery there too. And we were in the middle of this, and we lived in a house as a command post. We lived in the cellar, and we had the guns outside, and a very pleasant Dutch family called Smulders. And they had a, one of them was the head of the Amsterdam Bank in Nijmegen, and there were a couple of girls there, and another officer and I, for the next two or three months, whenever we got away, we used to go into Nijmegen and meet these girls and go to dances. I can't think whose dances they were, whether the army got a sort of club going of some description. Anyway, Nijmegen's life in the middle of this sort of battle going on around it, but not a very intense battle, Nijmegen was almost getting back to normal, a very pleasant town. It hadn't been that badly damaged. And then I think, trying to remember my the sequence of events. I think if I'm not careful, I'm going to get things wrong. But I think then in the autumn, the late autumn, we went right down south to near Maastricht in support of some attack towards a town called Heinsberg, which was towards the Rhine. Very muddy indeed, still in Holland, but in the sort of appendix of Holland that goes down to Maastricht. And somewhere down there, I remember, we went to some coal mines for baths, and I think they were the first proper baths we'd had since leaving England the previous June. They must have been the pit baths of this mine. I remember that quite well. And we liked the Dutch. The Dutch were terribly friendly the whole time we were in Holland. Very friendly people indeed, and delighted to see us. Very worried about the fact that the north of their country was still in German hands, because they'd thought they were all going to be liberated in September, and of course everything north of the Rhine, or the Waal, as they call it, was still in under the Germans, and they were having a desperate time up there. And of course, they had a lot of friends and relations, and they were very worried about that. But they were delightful. Anyway, this little battle down near Heinsberg faded out, and I think we made a small advances there towards the sort of Cologne area. And then we came back, and we were told we were going to have some leave. And we came up to somewhere outside Louvain in Belgium, and went into a village whose name I've forgotten. And that was the very first time that we'd been out of action since we'd landed in Normandy. And we had, I think, about a fortnight there. I got all this in the right order. I can't quite remember. No, I don't think I have, because... I think I've gone wrong. I think I've condensed. We didn't do that. When we'd left this place down in the Heinsberg area, we then went back up to Tilburg, right up in the north of Holland again. That's right. We went up to Tilburg. And there we were, that was just before Christmas of 44. Yes, we were just before Christmas, and we were all put into a pleasant town, Tilburg, and we were put into billets with the Dutch, and we, two or three of us in different houses, and they were all getting ready. We were going to have a tremendous Christmas there, and a bit of a break. That was the first time we'd come out of action. I've got that wrong. It was there. And then suddenly, literally in the middle of the night one night, we were all woken up and told to get going. And we all rushed off down to the Ardennes because the Germans had broken out, and Hitler's sort of last throw. He was hoping to get right through with a surprise attack on the Americans in the Ardennes area, and he thought he could get right through to Brussels. And there was a big German air attack on all the airfields in Belgium, which caught the RAF hopping, I think, and an enormous number of aircraft were lost on the ground. And this considerable tank attack through the Ardennes came quite a long way. And Montgomery was told to take command of it because the American command had rather fallen apart, and he was sent down there. And remember that there was an awful sort of row afterwards, and he made Monty did the usual thing of saying how clever he'd been. Which he usually was, a great fan. And I mean, I think he was terrific. I always remember the way he inspired us all before Normandy. I didn't mention earlier, when we all had to gather around in England, and he came down and jumped on top of a jeep and spoke to all the soldiers of every formation that was going out there. And he did it to us at Battle Abbey, at Hastings. And a soldier who was with me at the time, and is, I see now, he'd been our battery clerk. I mean, he always recalls that. And it's the one thing he remembers, I think, from just before the battle started. And Normandy, Montgomery gave one this terrific confidence that if he said it was going to be all right, it jolly well would be all right. And so one had great faith in him. Anyway, going back to the Ardennes, a number of British divisions, including ours, were sent down to sort of block the Germans, and we got down there with great difficulty. And I remember it quite well because it was my 21st birthday, and I had most of my 21st birthday sitting on the side of a road with a broken down Bren gun carrier somewhere outside Brussels on our way down. I suppose we came down through Namur to the Ardennes, and it was a very cold winter, and there was feet of snow. The roads were frozen, and everything slipped and slid, and it was very difficult indeed getting the guns down, and nothing would grip on the roads. And we did get in anyway, and we got into action, and by then, I think, the Germans had been stopped, and we were just firing to support sort of squeezing of this German salient out, and we stayed there for, I think, a week, 10 days, And then we came back, and that's when we went up and went and to sort of make up for the fact that we'd never had our Christmas break. We were then put into this village somewhere near Louvain for, I should think, a fortnight. And during that time, we all went, we were completely out of action, and after cleaning everything up and sort of resting and sleeping, the battery went in groups to Brussels, where clubs had been started, NAFI clubs, officers' clubs, and we had a great time. And we really were entertained marvellously, and I've always had a feeling for Brussels ever since. And you know, we had girlfriends there and so on. It was great. And then we began to get ready for the sort of final stages of the battle to get up to the Rhine and crossing the Rhine into Germany. And we drove up from that Belgian area all the way back again to where we'd been twice before, which was Nijmegen. And then we came into action just outside the Reichswald Forest. I'm not going to remember the name of that operation. Yes, I am. It was called Veritable. Veritable, that's right. And we had the biggest fire plan barrage we'd ever fired anywhere. And I think almost, well, probably as many guns as had been in the Normandy battles. The absolute solid mass of artillery to blast our way into this forest, vast forest, which stretches from Nijmegen right down to Cleve and another place called Goch. The Germans, to help their defence, flooded it. And a lot of the roads were underwater, and which delayed things. But we did eventually. It was a very messy and difficult battle, and a lot of confusion going through it in the forest. And we drove through eventually. I was trying to think which divisions we were supporting them, because 50 Div, which was our own original division, which the regiment had been with, 7th Medium had been with right from the very beginning of the war in Egypt, was eventually disbanded that autumn. It had had so many casualties, and there just weren't enough troops to keep filling these divisions up. And so a number of them were disbanded. And I think then we were probably with... the Canadian Army were running this, but it was mostly with British troops. And I can't quite remember. It was probably 43 or 53 did. And we came through the forest and came out the other side. I can remember two incidents there. One was driving along a forest track. I suddenly saw a mine slap in the middle, and we were going much too fast to stop. So I sort of closed my eyes and hoped for the best, and the driver kept his head, and we drove straight over the middle of it without touching it. That didn't go off, thank God. We then came into action at the far end, and the Germans were using mines everywhere. And we had to get the guns into action. I was then in a troop. I'd left battery headquarters, and I was in a troop as a GPO, gun position officer. And I was finding a field to put the guns in just to the west of the Rhine. And I saw what looked like a suitable place and walked in, told my truck to stop, and walked into the field and setting out where the guns should go. And I suddenly heard a hell of a bang behind me. And my truck had gone up on a mine, which had been in the gateway, which obviously hadn't gone off when I'd walked through. And it blew the truck apart, killed my signaller, who was in the back, slightly damaged the driver, destroyed all my own belongings in the back and everybody else's. And I always felt very guilty about that. I mean, it was, I suppose, you know, just one of those things, but I think there were a lot of mines about, and if I had taken a bit longer and gone rather slower, no doubt I might have picked up the fact that there was a mine in the gateway into the field. Anyway, there it was. Very nice chap called. We had a lot of Smiths in the battery. This was L. Smith, L.J., who'd been a signaller for me for many, many months, and I was very upset. And then, by chance, really, I happened to be due to go for a regular commissions board. And I'd already, of course, been a wartime officer, an emergency commission, but I decided that I wanted to be a regular soldier, like my father and grandfather. And the army had set up a regular commission board for people like that who wanted to become regulars back at Ghent, way away. And my battery commander, who thought I probably was a bit shocked by the signal having been killed, my truck blown up and everything, said, "All right, well, you go off." This was the next day, and take my jeep and my driver, and go off and do your regular commission board. And so I did, and we drove back through. We went to Tilburg first, where we'd had that abortive Christmas when we'd been chased down to the Ardennes. It was roughly on the way, so the driver and I decided we'd stay the night at Tilburg. And I remember that frightfully well, because the area Dutch woman only had one spare room with a huge feather bed in it, and she put us both in the same bed, which always strikes me as being rather funny. The soldier and I shared a bed that night. Gunner Edmeads, his name was, nice boy, and then went on to Ghent for the regular commission board. And as usual, when you arrived, that sort of thing, the first thing that somebody says is, "Well, have you got the right kit?" And you were meant to bring all sorts of things like binoculars and gum boots and this and that for the various courses you were doing, and compass. And I hadn't got anything because all my kit had been blown up, and my boxes and camera and everything. So I said, "Well, no, I haven't." And the chap said, "Why not?" And I said, "Well, my truck was blown up in a mine the day before yesterday, and all my kit was destroyed." And he did believe me. Well, the driver obviously could have corroborated it. And I was also extremely bad at the assault course, because as a gunner, one had spent a lot of time. Although you sort of run about the gun position much, you don't take a hell of a lot of exercise. You spend a lot of it sitting on your bottom on a radio or sitting in the command post or whatever. And I was not fit. And I found climbing trees and skinning down ropes very hard work. And I thought, well, I'm going to fail this course. And in the end, I passed out really very well indeed. And I'm sure it was actually because the chap felt sorry for me because my kit had been blown up. But you never know. Anyway, I did pass it and went back to the battery, who had moved, I think, once since then, and we were now on the Rhine, just behind the Rhine, opposite a place called... Oh God, what was that town called? Wesel. Yes, I mentioned Wesel earlier with reference to the Maas, didn't I? And I was wrong. I've forgotten. It wasn't Wesel on the Maas. It was somewhere else. This was Wesel, which was a biggish town on the Rhine, on the far bank, and we were just about opposite that. And this was by then March 45, and this was Montgomery's great assault across the Rhine with the British Army to finish off the war. Of course, the Americans had already bounced across the Rhine at Remagen further down, but Monty had set up a great attack across with airborne troops dropping, 6th Airborne Div this time, on the far side. And there was an enormous smoke screen. Smoke machines had been set up all along the dike on the bank